from HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan, announcing show number 192, recorded live Thursday, December 10th, 2009. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks with ASP.NET team member Louis DeJardin.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm here today on magical video call with Lou DeJardin, or as I like to think about him in my head, Louis DeJardin, but I understand that's not how your name is pronounced, sir. And you're working for the Microsoft now, but your claim to fame, at least the claim to fame that I like to think about you, is the Spark View Engine. Can you tell me a little about Spark for the listeners who may not be familiar with it?
Sure. It's a view engine. It was originally created as one of the iView engine implementations for MVC. When Preview 3, when it came out, is when it first was added. And it's been ported to Monorail, and there's also a core DLL that can be used kind of anywhere. It's just a templating engine, really.
So it's a templating engine. It sounds like you kind of blow it off like, oh, it's just a templating engine, but it's kind of a big deal. I mean, when you write a view engine or a templating engine, you're making kind of a statement, because for the listeners who are not familiar with ASP.NET MVC, a view engine really replaces the angle bracket generator within ASP.NET itself and makes a declaration that here's a better way to make HTML. Here's a better DSL, right? It's a domain specific language for generating HTML, is it not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, HTML is kind of a DSL itself, and mm-hmm. it's always kind of a mess when you have two languages put together, at least that's been my experience. And so we were using nVelocity for a while on Monorail on one project, and, mm-hmm. and we noticed that the code didn't fight with HTML as much, and the views ended up looking cleaner, and the HTML specialists, the designers, really liked those effects because it felt natural to them when they opened the files. So in you know, starting Spark, that a lot of that experience carried into it to try to make it look like HTML, even the things that were code.
You know, in MVC by default, we get the Web Forms View Engine, which is there kind of for a couple of reasons. One, it's default. Web Forms is what ASP.NET originally used. So your ASPX pages are there because they're familiar. And then there are other view engines that people swap in and out of MVC. There's one called Enamel, which is based on a Ruby view engine. Did you invent Spark from scratch? You just kind of sat down and said, I wish that there was something that looked like this, or was there an inspiration from some other view engine?
Actually, that was kind of the root of it came from one of Phil Hack's blog posts, and there's a link to it on the sparkviewengine.com site. The origin of Spark was a conversation thread that kind of wound around how you would do a repeater in different view engines, and it kind of turned into an aesthetic discussion. And somebody sort of had like a leading question was, if you were going to just from scratch, don't worry about like what ASPX looks like or what nVelocity looks like, what would you look like? You know, what would you want it to look like? And so my reply was, well, I want a for element with an each attribute. You know, that's because then, you know, it'll lay out an XML and it'll be all those kind of things. So from that sense, it was you know, it's all from scratch, but it borrows from concepts from other view engines. And that's really the fundamental premise is it should all look like one language, one DSL.
And one of the things about the Web Forms view engine, of course, since it's using the Web Forms processor, even though there's no postback model in Web Forms, you've got the notion of a code block. So you're constantly switching contexts. You're in a code block with an angle bracket percent, and then you're in doing some HTML, and you kind of hop back and forth. Spark is, I don't know, I wouldn't say confusing initially, but it's definitely dramatic in that, like, for example, if you were going to do a list of LIs, right, of list items, you'd say open bracket LI, and then there's actually an each attribute on the on that element. So you'd say li space each equals, and then you'd have some code, but there isn't really that obvious context switching. Help me understand this. There isn't really an each attribute on a list item in HTML. Am I writing HTML or am I writing Spark?
Well, the each attribute is an example of like successive or iterative reduction in the amount of things that you have to type. Spark does allow you to escape code just like you can in ASPX. It does understand the less than percent syntax as well. So you can do C#, you know, for each var x and y, open curly brace. The for element with an each attribute is going to generate that same line, and you can wrap it around HTML so that it looks like it's well formed. In using that, the idea of just taking the each attribute and putting it on the element inside of there was just something that kind of seemed intuitive after writing a couple of these for each things. Even the for element seemed kind of redundant because, you know, 70% of the time you were repeating a particular tag and the tag had a close. And so when you put the each attribute on there, really it's adding the silent for in the background. There's a compiler that just takes these special attributes and creates the invisible for around it.
But you can put a for, there is a for attribute though, right? If one wanted one.
Oh yeah, there's a for element with an each attribute, and you can put the each attribute on any element really, and it'll sort of be taken off of that element, and a for will be put around the element that the each was on. So there's a couple of within the templating, there's only a couple of things that are really flow control for the views. There's like an if and an each. There's also a once, which is something you can add in order to say deduplicate script source if you're building up a header area. Mm-hmm. You can say once jQuery, and jQuery is kind of like a symbol so that if that appears several times all over the place, only the first time that element will be used. The rest of the times they'll just be skipped.
Interesting. Now, Spark was created when the idioms, the kind of common idioms for HTML already existed. So things like doing an alternating row, like, you know, you're going to be switching back and forth between two list items, having like even and odd CSS classes or having a grid of information. Those things, those kind of things that we saw when we look at a user interface didn't really exist when ASP.NET originally started. Are there things within Spark that are set up, like, you know, idioms, language idioms that are set up to make it output these common kinds of HTML easier than other view engines?
Right, yeah, and that's probably one of the things that kind of drives Spark design more than anything is in the context of, you know, creating a, you know, website with hundreds of views, you see those kind of things that you do over and over and require too much code, so that's kind of what drives the features. And in the looping example, when there is a loop, so you're like for foo in foos, if you want to take advantage of some automatic variables that are generated, you can refer to foo index with a capital I, or foo count, foo is first, foo is last, those types of things. Mm-hmm. And if you refer to those, it'll generate the kind of boilerplate, you know, booleans and integers within the for loop, you know, as Chrome around that iteration, so that it's just removing some of the code that you would have had to type in context every time you wanted to get a, you know, a count or an is first or is last. So you can do an alternating row by putting a, you know, just your class equals and then a quote and then alt or whatever your class name is. Mm-hmm. and then make that conditional on foo index mod 2. Yeah, and another optimization beyond that is like foo is even, foo is odd. Mm-hmm. as additional auto variables, but it's been requested, it hasn't been added yet though.
Now, sometimes when I see, I know we're talking about code on an audio podcast, which is always funny. We'll have to have you maybe on .NET Rocks TV or something to show us how to do this. I'm kind of more interested in the language design because have you designed a language before? I mean, it's kind of an amazing story that you were on Phil's blog and you guys were kicking stuff around and then you said, gosh, you know, what would it be like if such and such a thing existed? And then you actually went off and did it. I mean, there's so many things in open source where someone's talks about doing something, but to actually go and do it, it's nice. It's refreshing when someone actually, talk is cheap, show me the code. Did you sit down and design the language? Had you designed parsers and lexers and stuff before?
And the thing is to just go from a blog post and sit down and think to yourself, I'm going to create, a production ready view engine that anybody can use is insane. You'd never get to the end of it. You'd never get beyond the design phase. So it really started as like so in the blog post. I was just putting together a small view engine sample as kind of a code form of what I was saying as an illustration. Like here's how that would really work in just like a toy language, and it kind of just one feature at a time, really. It's like, and then, you can declare view data in a strongly typed fashion if you just did this. This would be nice if it did loops also. So it kind of turned into a real view engine, incrementally, little bit by bit. I've been working on code for it's frightening when you think, more than a decade, 15 years, something like that. Mm-hmm. So you bump into these kind of problems all the time, just different little parsing problems. There was one time a user interface that was created as a contracting job, which involved, a company's own DSL. They had a batch processing software. There's little bits and pieces of experience you have in the past from creating parsers and breaking down language.
Now, all of this is open source, so people can go and look at how you structured this. But I think that some of the, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think some of the really interesting design things that may not be immediately obvious to the average user of MVC is that this is a complete engine in itself. You're not using ASP.NET web forms or any of the ASP.NET things that we know of to do the parsing. I mean, you have your own parsing. And one of the things I think is significant is that in web forms, proper in actual web forms, of course, we've got the postback model and we've got view state and all these kinds of things. But in the web forms view engine in MVC, there is still the parsing and creation of a control tree and then the rendering of that control tree. And that still happens in MVC. But in Spark, that doesn't. Is that correct?
Right. Spark parsing, actually, the parsing isn't even using an XML DOM. It's just using the XML grammar to recognize parts, but that grammar is implemented in its own set of grammar statements. The code that's generated is a single class file, and it's very minimalistic. It's very deconstructs the whole problem down to a view turns into a class that has an output property that's a text writer, and all of this stuff gets, parsed, transformed, mutilated a little bit, and just generates write statements. So it's all a bunch of output write statements, and then the code of the for loops and the little evals are mixed in there too. So it turns into a single class that's instantiated, and kind of a single method that has all of the output statements and flow control sort of woven into it.
Hey, everybody, this is Scott coming at you from another place and time. No doubt you probably bump into testing tasks now and then in your work, and writing functional tests is probably not your favorite thing. It's kind of difficult, takes time, and the results can be dubious. Well, get ready to start liking tests thanks to Telerik with the new WebEye testing framework. Building web automation tests is a breeze. You've got code automation with advanced ASP.NET Ajax and Silverlight applications. You can write a single test, have it executed against multiple browsers at once. You benefit from a rich API. There's link support, integration with Visual Studio unit testing, also NUnit, XUnit, and MBUnit. not to mention the free wrappers for Telerik RAD controls for ASP.NET AJAX and Silverlight, all shipping with Telerik's new testing tool. One of the best features, the WebEye testing framework, which is developed by Art of Test, is it's absolutely free. If you've already got hooked on WebEye testing framework, start using it right away. Go to Telerik.com for more info. Thanks a lot. Okay, so let me see if I understand this. So you do custom parsing. I assume there's a regular expression in there somewhere, right? You're parsing the text internally. Do you create an abstract syntax tree of some kind, or is this a straight transformation from your kind of quasi-HTML syntax into a bunch of calls to text writer and write line?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it goes through two stages. It goes through the grammar that breaks it into things that are sort of a node representation. So in that sense, it's classes that are start and end tags, attributes, those kind of things. So it's very node-like, and then there's some processing that goes on with a visitor pattern where that's the stage where like the each attributes kind of are pulled out and become a sort of implied for node around there. So there's some manipulation that occurs at that level. Those nodes are then turned into chunks. So the last stage of node processing builds arrays of chunks, and those are more code-like. So those would be where there's a loop chunk or an output writing chunk or a literal, just HTML text that passed through writing chunk. So that's more code-like representation. There's a little bit of processing that occurs there, but not much. And then it basically goes through each of those chunks and another visitor kind of turns them into code. So it turns them into a node representation. They're mutilated a little bit, changes them into a chunk representation. One last chance to make any changes. And then they go right out to a language. And the chunks can actually go out to a couple of different languages. Somebody requested once if there was any client-side rendering of Spark. And it was pretty easy to do just by making a different chunk visitor that would write out JavaScript instead of C#.
So I'm not sure. I don't quite understand. What do you mean a client-side representation? You're saying that you can write Spark and have Spark generate JavaScript?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just like you can create a C# and compile it and instantiate it for server-side execution, you can go to a Spark template and say, turn this into JavaScript, and it'll parse and transform and generate JavaScript, which is, a bunch of the same things, writes and loops and stuff like that. So you can get that JavaScript to the client as a script source, and it essentially is a function that you can call and pass it a JSON object or, data bearing object, and it'll return a string of, that view having turned that object into HTML.
Now, maybe I'm getting off in the weeds a little bit here, but is that an obscure and interesting thing you did for one guy, or is that something that everyone would care about?
That was something that somebody asked about, and it seemed interesting, and then, thinking about it, I thought it seemed doable, and then, it only took like a day on the weekend. Because really, it was just going through the chunks and saying, okay, this chunk writes out literal. Oh, I know how to do that in JavaScript. This is a loop. That's doable. And so, just bit by bit, it all, implement 12 different types of chunks, and then you've got a JavaScript version of a Spark view.
Now, when I sit down and look at some open source thing, if I decide to visit sparkviewengine.com and I say, oh, well, this is interesting, but it's such a fundamental thing, it's such a personal thing, the choice of one's view engine, especially when you've used web forms for so very long, I would look at this and I'd say, wow, this looks nice. It's a polished site. Wow, that's an interesting syntax. But then I'd say, but I bet that if there's like one misplaced space or, I don't close a tag, this thing is going to be impossible to debug. And I don't know why I have that sense. Maybe I've gotten burned by other open source applications where someone tries to create their own language, but they don't go kind of all the way.
Yeah.
What kind of help do I get? What kind of debugging do I get? Especially with code generation, if there's a misplaced curly brace, what kind of chaos happens?
Yeah, well, as with all things, the Visual Studio integration is not and probably never will be as refined as the default view engines. But in order for it to be as convenient as possible, and again, it's not a theoretical view engine. It's created in the crucible of creating an application with lots of people at the same time. So those kind of pains would be felt immediately, by everybody. So one of the things it does is when there's an exception or a problem from compiling, mm-hmm. it throws the entire, generated code back at you as the exception message. Your yellow screen of death is huge, but it pretty much says, okay, here in the view is something I didn't understand, or I got a compiler error on, line 85 and line 32. Not in that order. But then you scroll down through the yellow screen for line 85, and it's like, oh yeah, look at that. That's my typo.
So you don't even try to hide the underlying generated code and tell them something friendly and then map it back to the line of Spark. You just say, well, here's what happened.
Well, there's something kind of friendly at the top, because it's that type of error happens when, the code is generated and it's thrown to the C# code DOM to compile. It'll come back with an array of errors, the same that, your build output has. So you'll have those errors at the top, and then pretty much the source that was generated is shown to you, just so that, there's no other way to get somebody so that they can see, the context of what really happened when, the compiler failed. Beyond that, there's, what else is there? Oh, the... C# has a couple of pragmas where you can say the source line number and file path from code. So Spark does include those also in the generated code.
So when you say line numbers, you mean line numbers of the source. So I might be on line 100 of the generated stuff, and then you would have a pound pragma that says I'm really on line 50.
Right. So in the generated file, it's very large, but there'll be a pragma that says this is on, C:\projects/something/something.spark, line mm-hmm. 5. So the line of code that's generated refers to the original view, and it's one of those things that's kind of amazing to see work, just because it was not much work to put those lines in. But what happens is the Spark view is compiled into an assembly that has debug symbols pointing to the original view. So when an exception fires at runtime, it'll bring up that Spark view file and it'll highlight that line as if that's where the code came from. And you can even single step and look at the local variables, because the debugger thinks you're debugging that generated file, so it knows all the local variables in that function and your context. But the file you're looking at, it's showing you essentially a different file because the debug symbols lied. It said, okay, well, I'm at this symbolic breakpoint. When I'm at this breakpoint, show this file at this, spot. It's kind of weird. But yeah, you can set breakpoints and you can step through code and you can look at variables when you're in a .spark file as it's rendering.
Really? And you didn't have to do a lot of work for that at all. It's just basically Visual Studio expects that people will want to do this at some point. So.
Oh yeah. The way that Visual Studio is set up with ASPX files is that they already have the idea of C# as a contained language, that type of thing. So there was a lot of stuff done in Visual Studio to make debugging web forms work, and Spark is just kind of taking advantage of that work. When web forms generate files, they do the same thing. They put that sort of like, well, here's code, but this line is really that one in that other file. So when you're single stepping, show that one. So you mm-hmm. can step through an ASPX page. Spark is just taking advantage of that mechanism in the same way.
That's interesting, because I was trying to get my head around whether Spark was truly trying to be a language, and you did kind of Lex and Yak type stuff like we did in college to create its own language, or if this is really a transformation. It seems like it's more of a DSL. In the that transforms into something else, and then you get to take advantage of a lot of the language capabilities that are available to you, kind of from the ambient ASP.NET engine. You don't even have to really look at your code blocks, do you?
No. Look at your code blocks.
Like for example, if I say something like in Spark, like var classes equals new array something. Are you parsing that whole thing out, or do you just see the var classes element and attribute, and then just transform it into some C sharp? I'm trying to understand how much do you have to actually think about the contents, the code itself, versus just pass it along and transform it into C sharp?
It's 99% just passing it along.
I'm not trying to minimize your work or something, actually. I'm just thinking about how much was given to us. So if someone were to try to do something like this themselves, how scary is this?
Oh, yeah. No. I'll be the first one to minimize it. Really, it is a parser and a code generator. It's not a compiler. It's using the code DOM from C#. And it is not a execution engine or an evaluation engine or an interpreter or anything like that. It's that entire problem domain passes right through Spark and is handed over to the C# language, which is one of the things that, from the AnVelocity monorail background, They had an interpreter and a little language for, variable, output and evaluation that was reflection-based. Mm-hmm. And it was a lot like C#, but not exactly. So like array access, for example, you couldn't use the square brace. And there were little things like that every so often you had a model that you were trying to show a property or something on that you couldn't quite do it just with something that looked like C#. So that was one of the reasons to kind of try to just let that whole problem domain fly right through and not worry about it. Because then you get 100% C#, like every feature of C#, even the, length statements on enumerators, you can do those in a for each, extension methods. Everything is just kind of delegated to that existing system.
Well, that's actually kind of funny because it lets you take credit for the language underneath. It makes Spark look great, right? Because these little snippets get passed on to C#, but it makes Spark look that much more full featured. So you're standing on the shoulders of giants.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Spark doesn't do looping. Spark just writes code.
Now, one of the things I wanted to kind of back up and then fork off of was the idea that because you're not making an intermediate step of a control tree, we'll call it, the classic ASP.NET web forms way, I'm just going out on a limb here, taking a chance. Would it be fair to say that Spark either is or could be faster just in the parsing and spitting out angle brackets kind of things than the ASP.NET web forms engine itself?
Well, yes, and I think that the way that you could look at that is that it's not, because SparkWrite is a class that's created and executed, and it's a single pass through a function, it's not necessarily that it's faster or that web forms is inefficient. It's just that it's doing so little. It does almost nothing. It's not really possible for it to be, slower than anything other than, C++ code or something like that. And even that might be, kind of a dead heat in some cases. But it's really just, a single function call. So in that sense, it's minimalistic. The thing is that, Web Forms Engines does a lot more. Spark is very specific to a particular problem of being a view in an MVC, structure. So the view is responsible for not very much because of the separation of concerns. That all you really need is, single pass-through function. You don't need to...
You're saying, I just want to back up to make sure that the listeners understand. You're saying single pass-through function as opposed to... You're saying that Spark does so little because it's just dumping out a big function that you call and it's calling TextWriter, right? Versus WebForms view engine that does what?
Spark, for example, doesn't have a lifecycle of the components it maintains. It doesn't create several different objects from several different assemblies.
Mm-hmm.
And walk them through the process of restoring their state and rendering and you're recapturing and serializing state. All of those types of things are outside of the problem domain of MVC. Spark doesn't support server controls, basically. It's got no ability to do that whatsoever. But if you're okay with that and you're willing to, you know, give up server controls, you can, you know, make many, many, many assumptions that just reduce the amount of work that the view is doing.
Yeah, the server controls was my next question. So, but you still support partial views, though, and the kinds of things that were the kinds of conveniences that we're used to in MVC?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. The HTML and all of those other helpers are present in the base class. So partial view, editor for, template for, all of those helpers can be used, and they operate exactly the same way.
Ah, good. So I can use the HTML helpers that I've already written?
Mm-hmm.
And I can use, you just brought up editor for and display for. These are MVC2 helpers. Those work too.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And the way that MVC is written, you can, kind of interop between languages. So you can have a web forms view showing a Spark partial file or vice versa. So you're not, you know, when you say, you know, editor for or partial view, you can jump languages at the same time.
Ah, that's cool. So I don't have to, if I was going to introduce Spark to my company, it's not like I have to go and give a brown bag and get all the developers in and say, all right, we're going to move everything over to Spark. We can just try a couple of views.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, you can register the Spark view engine. And, you know, just like all view engines, it's kind of based on the extension. So you can change some existing ASCX to a .spark or, you know, and they can be side by side. So it there's two things that make migration a little bit easier. One is that you can run side by side for a long time, and the other is that Spark recognizes the angle bracket percent syntax for code snippets and for output expressions. So you don't even need to rewrite the view 100% in order to be, you know, a Spark view. You just have
okay.
to change the thing.
So, whoa, that's cool. So, the Spark syntax that I'm used to for code blocks is the $ curly brace. And you're saying I can even mix and match and use the old angle bracket percent style.
Oh, yeah. The parser treats them as an alias. They're recognized as the same thing when they're turned into a node. So, the second it's turned from text into nodes, they're the same at that point.
Well, that'll make porting my existing views over nicely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yep. Streamlines it a lot. And, you know, the HTML.encode inside of those mm-hmm. works the same, one way or the other. Spark has H function, which is a shorter version of HTML encode, but HTML encode works too. So if you have angle bracket percent equal HTML.encode foo, that'll work in Spark just fine.
That's very cool. So Spark is at version 1 on CodePlex, and it's under the Apache license. It came out in June. That's about 6 months ago. What's next for Spark?
Oh, well, the thing is working at Microsoft now.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of time that's free time has mysteriously dropped down a little bit. So the rate of change of Spark has cut back a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But the next thing coming up would be MVC2 integration. There is in the build, there's a version of Spark DLL that comes out, mm-hmm. which is compiled against MVC2 bits that are public. So the next thing would be just to make that the main target. So Spark is completely switched over to MVC2. There's also, one of the things that I really want to do is widen out the ownership of it.
Yeah, that was my next question. Are you working on this by yourself, or do you have a team of ninjas?
Well, it's on GitHub, so there are contributors that happen all the time. It's a very streamlined process. You know, you just fork and you commit and then you pull. So, mm-hmm. so it's easy to get changes around. The main Spark repository that the build server runs off of and that most people get code from, mm-hmm. I'm the only one that has commit rights to it right now.
Okay.
So I think that's something that.
So it's a single committer style of open source project so far.
Yeah. Yeah. Many, many contributors, but kind of a single, you know, repository with one person with commit rights. But that's something I think that needs to change pretty quickly. in order to make sure that, yeah.
Well, Lou, I appreciate you sitting down and getting me up to speed on what's going on with Spark. Maybe someday it'll come with ASP.NET MVC. That'd be cool.
Yeah, I think that's the other thing people ask for all the time.
But just ship it, right? Ship it along with it.
Mm-hmm, yeah, just like jQuery, why not?
I guess that's possible, though, right? Now that we're doing all sorts of crazy stuff around open source, you can't assume that we won't do something crazy like ship your stuff, you know, Apache license and all, right?
Yeah, just throw it in CodePlex Foundation and bundle it all together.
Very cool. All right, well, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'll see you again next week.